Minnesota's communities with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. I'm Gracie Jay. This week, we continue our coverage of the intensified federal immigration operations in Minnesota and the growing public response. In recent days, a right-wing group rallied in downtown Minneapolis and was met by counter-protesters, while daily confrontations continue between ICE agents and demonstrators at the Whipple Federal Building in the Twin Cities, where the agency has its local headquarters. Only about a dozen people showed up for what was promoted to be a massive anti-Islamic protest in downtown Minneapolis. Fearing a violent clash, those opposing the racist rally discouraged counter-protests. A few hundred counter-protesters chased the main organizer out of the city, who claimed to have been stabbed but appeared to have scrapes and cuts. Protesters also disrupted a church service, prompting a federal investigation, and students around the state have walked out of classes in solidarity with those affected by immigration enforcement. In response, Minnesota officials have put the National Guard on standby, and the president has placed a United States Army unit on standby, threatening to send U.S. military troops to our state. These are just some of the events from last week. We begin this week's program with reactions from tribal members who say federal agents are not recognizing tribal identification cards. And we'll take a look at how the immigration crackdown in the Twin Cities is impacting local businesses and communities. But first, here's a deeper look at some of the news-making headlines around the state this past week. The U.S. Department of Justice is accusing Governor Walz, the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Attorney General Ellison, and two counties of violating federal law by impeding federal law enforcement officials. The Department of Justice issued grand jury subpoenas seeking written records and communications from those city and state officials. In a statement, Governor Walz denied any wrongdoing and called the reported investigation a political attack, saying the justice system is being weaponized against opponents. The Minneapolis mayor responded on the social media platform X that he will not be intimidated and his focus remains on keeping the city safe. The federal law cited has rarely been used and has roots going back to the Civil War era. In related news, Becca Good, the widow of Renee Good, who was shot and killed by ICE officers earlier this month in Minneapolis, is now the subject of a federal investigation. News reports say rather than focusing on Officer Jonathan Ross, who fired the fatal shot, federal authorities are now examining whether Becca Good broke the law by impeding federal officers.
That's fine, dude. I'm not mad at you.
Show your face.
I'm not mad at
you. That's okay. We don't change our plates every morning, just so you know.
An attorney for Becca Good released a statement on January 17th saying that as of that time, no federal agency had contacted his client to indicate they were investigating her. Six federal prosecutors in Minnesota resigned, reportedly under pressure from the Justice Department to pursue criminal charges against Renee Good's family. The Justice Department responded, saying it fired the prosecutors who said they resigned. North Star Stories is unable to confirm which happened first. The U.S. Department of Justice says it's investigating a group of protesters who disrupted Sunday services at a St. Paul church. Protesters claim one of the pastors, David Easterwood, also leads the local ICE field office. Church listings and court records appear to match that identity. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi said on the social media platform X that any federal violations would be prosecuted. The U.S. Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division also pointed out on X that creating an unsafe atmosphere or intimidating people at a religious site is against federal law. Campuses across the state are updating their safety policies due to concerns of federal activity. The University of Minnesota updated guidance for students, faculty, and staff as federal operations continue, adding that it will offer virtual learning options for some students. St. Cloud State officials reminded students and staff that immigration agents face the same access rules as other law enforcement and urge anyone approached for information about others to direct officers to the president's office. High school students across the Twin Cities organized walkouts to support classmates affected by recent immigration operations. During a press conference, a high school student expressed pride in his fellow students.
When I showed up at school, all classrooms felt so empty, and there wasn't the same life that there had been in school because so many Somalian and Latino families weren't there, my friends and classmates. Then later in the day, when we were going for the walkout, I felt so grateful because of the amount of people that showed up. I'm so grateful to my community members that supported me and all the kids that showed up to protest against all the things that ICE had been doing.
A number of K-12 school districts around the metro are offering remote learning during the immigration crackdown. Some schools in greater Minnesota are talking about offering that possibility, but none have done so as of our recording of this newscast. You are listening to North Star Stories. In today's main story, after recent ICE arrests of Native Americans in the Twin Cities, tribal governments and community groups are mobilizing around one concrete step they can take right now: issuing tribal ID cards and trying to ensure ICE agents know about, recognize, and honor them. Reporter Zan Holston has more.
I'm 53 years old, you know, and growing up here in the Twin Cities, and I never thought I'd have to carry my Bad River Chippewa tribal ID around my neck on a lanyard.
Crow Belcourt grew up in the Little Earth community, a native housing complex in South Minneapolis. He's president of the Indigenous Protector Movement, IPM, and the son of American Indian Movement, or AIM, co-founder Clyde Belcourt. Over the past several weeks, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has arrested Native Americans in Minneapolis and nearby suburbs. Tribal leaders and advocates say agents are stopping people without warrants and without knowing who they're actually looking for.
What a problem we're running into that I heard is that ICE agents are looking at these tribal IDs and thinking that they're fake, that they're not real.
That concern has pushed tribal governments and urban Indian organizations to act quickly to focus on one concrete thing they can provide right now: tribal identification cards. Tribal IDs are tribally issued, federally recognized identification, a valid form of government ID accepted at federal buildings, airports, and banks. At the Minneapolis American Indian Center, tribal staff from across the region are issuing free IDs to enrolled members, many of whom don't live on their home reservations.
From not just our Minnesota tribes, but also from South Dakota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, because we have such a vibrant Native community here in the Twin Cities.
One of those tribes is North Central Minnesota's Red Lake Nation.
And we have over 8,000 tribal members that live in the Twin Cities, and we're going to protect each and every one of them and our descendants.
Sam Strong is Red Lake's tribal secretary.
There's a lot of people that are worried about the recent actions and activities, and so we're bringing our staff down here. We're going to give out free IDs and, you know, whatever we can do to protect our people. We're here for them.
Strong says the urgency became impossible to ignore after ICE arrested a Red Lake descendant, a U.S. citizen whose mother is an enrolled member of the tribe. Red Lake leadership helped provide documentation proving his citizenship and securing his release. Just days later, reports emerged that ICE had detained four unhoused men believed to be members of the Oglala Sioux tribe who were living beneath a bridge near the Little Earth community. One man has since been released, but at a news conference last week, Oglala Sioux leaders said they have not been able to confirm whether their enrolled citizens were taken into custody and are still seeking clear answers from ICE. The uncertainty about who has been detained, where they're being held, and why has only intensified frustration across Native communities. Along Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis, everyday community spaces have become places of protection and coordination. At Powwow Grounds, a Native-run coffee shop, the All My Relations Art Gallery has been repurposed into a hub where people observe ICE activity, share information, and take care of one another. Volunteers coordinate observers who document ICE encounters. Others focus on mutual aid, making sure people have food, warm clothing, and support if they're afraid to leave their homes.
Medical supplies to hats, mittens, gloves, hand warmers, household stuff for people who are afraid to get to the store in these times. And we also have soup and coffee for people who are out on the streets protesting with ICE.
Belcourt says what he's seeing now feels familiar and deeply racialized.
It's just crazy that they don't have warrants. They don't know who they're looking for. They just see brown faces and pull you over, mess with you. Give me your ID.
Earlier this month, that played out just across the street from Powwow Grounds. Rachel Dion Thunder, vice president of the Indigenous Protector Movement, was driving through the area when ICE agents stopped her.
ICE attempted to detain me just here across the street. Directly across the street from Powwow Grounds.
Dion Thunder says agents surrounded her car and demanded that she roll down her windows and show identification. She refused.
They were ready to break my window.
As the situation escalated, observers and community members rushed in, filming, blowing whistles, and surrounding her vehicle.
And what I experienced in that moment was protection and power from our people.
The agents eventually left, but Dion Thunder says those encounters make clear who's being targeted.
Carrying identification does not guarantee safety. People are being taken and detained regardless.
She says the response now is collective care.
If you can, and if you want, please stay home. Continue to move in prayer, stay grounded, and continue to look out for one another.
Tribal members in Minneapolis are encouraged to contact tribal leadership for more information about getting IDs or to contact the Minneapolis American Indian Center. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
The state has 11 sovereign nations, so this impacts many Minnesotans. I'm joined by Louise Mattson from White Earth Band of Ojibwe and Executive Director of the Division of Indian Work. Welcome to North Star Stories, Louise.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So from what you're seeing, how have these recent ICE actions changed day-to-day life for tribal members and Native families?
Well, it's had a huge impact. At the Division of Indian Work, we are trying to proceed with business as usual. So for example, we have a food shelf, but we do have people that are afraid to come up to the food shelf. Again, we know we're being racially profiled and we've seen violent abductions for people. So there's a very real fear. We are suspending our evening activities because we do pickups for youth. My fear is not only could they be followed and stopped, because we know that's happened, but they could also drive into a situation that's bad. And so evening groups are temporarily suspended. We're taking it week by week. So that's a loss of academic and cultural support and caring adult support for our young people. And that's across the board for a lot of our agencies. We've had to alter our plans. And I will remind folks that, yes, we have 11 nations in Minnesota, but in Minneapolis, I've heard that there's 150 different tribal nations represented. We're very diverse, you know, so we're multi-tribal and we're multiracial. So not everybody can get a tribal ID card. A lot of nations are doing the descendants card, but some are not. And some, like, their tribal nation doesn't have a representative here. But I will say I'm really impressed with a lot of tribes are sending people down. I've never seen it before for tribes I've never heard coming down here and doing tribal IDs for free.
So then what other protections or policies would you like to see to make sure tribal members can safely access food, clinics, and other basic services?
Yeah, they just have to hopefully be connected with someone like Division of Indian Work, or we have legal aid department here. We're all very well connected with who can help people legally if they're detained. And then all these protectors that are out there patrolling, like Indigenous Protectors Movement and volunteers who are keeping an eye on things. So word rapidly spreads and this network of people helping to keep people safe. But, you know, we are understanding that people are staying home because they're afraid. I said, we're open for our food shelf, but our doors are locked. So I feel like we're a sanctuary. So we actually have a volunteer watching our door. Our Native community loves to be in community with one another. So we are letting people in and watching the door and watching to see if federal agents come so that we can react.
So then looking ahead, if this level of enforcement continues, what long-term impacts do you worry about for security and economic stability in tribal communities, both in the Twin Cities and in greater Minnesota?
Well, I worry about food insecurity. We've worked really hard to try to make sure that we lessen that in our community. But, you know, are we reaching everybody? We, you know, and also the people that are delivering the food, are they safe? You know, they're out there in the community. Also, people are not receiving the services that they need for support. So that academic support, that homework help. We do a lot of cultural activities. They're missing that. And they're missing that across the board on a lot of agencies. All the youth who have already been really impacted by COVID, we're still recovering from that. But we all know how that impacted children and like their academic skills, particularly reading. So all those supports that help for that are not happening. And the longer they go, the more that hurts our youth. And then just, I think, the trauma that this is putting on community, and I'm including the community members that work at all these different agencies that are trying to balance serving our people and our community with, I'm really struggling because I'm worried or some of my own family have been targeted. It's exhausting.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Louise. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but still, we appreciate talking with you.
Thank you.
After the break, how business owners and communities are feeling the impact of immigration enforcement in the Twin Cities. This is North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, produced by Ampers with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
Ampers is diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. We are an association of 17 independent community radio stations in Minnesota with over 300,000 listeners. We support our stations through revenue, training, and original news, arts, and cultural programs. Ampers programming is produced for and by the communities in our station's regions and aims to correct narratives about historically underrepresented groups. Check out what we're up to online at ampers.org, on Instagram, and Facebook.
You are listening to North Star Stories. I'm Gracie J. While communities across the state are reeling as immigration enforcement actions continue to escalate, two hotels in downtown St. Paul closed, at least temporarily, citing safety concerns for their guests. And on St. Paul's east side, small businesses from restaurants to daycare centers are feeling the impact. As Nak Bui tells us, some are even struggling to stay afloat.
St. Paul's east side is known as a lively and vibrant hotbed of immigrant communities and businesses. But these days, things are quiet.
It's a very difficult situation for the old businesses, no matter if it's a Latino businesses or other businesses. We have many other businesses around, but you see the streets are empty.
For safety, this business owner did not want to be identified. But he says since December, when federal immigration enforcement intensified, he's seen revenue drop 50 to 60%. Several of his employees are also too afraid to come to work.
We are working only with three employees right now. It's like 60%. The people don't come. And I talk to my neighbors, and they are the same. Because there's no sales, no people, no workers.
Due to the situation, he's had to cut hours and keep the front doors locked at all times.
Weekly is over 15 hours less. And it's not good for the community because the people need to buy stuff all the time.
It's a decision other businesses are making as well.
So it's not necessarily that they're running closed, but they are saying, we have reduced all kinds of things because we have reduced customers coming in. And we're really worried about how we're going to meet our obligations to pay our bills.
That's Paris Dunning, executive director of the Eastside Area Business Association, or ESABA. Dunning says ESABA doesn't have an exact number of how many businesses are impacted, but several have reached out for support in recent days. Some places on the east side, like Taqueria Los Ocampo, have had to close entirely for the foreseeable future, leaving only a handwritten note on their door to let customers know. Some fear these closures could become permanent.
When they say, we're not sure we can last much longer, they are saying, this is COVID-level impact.
Unlike during the pandemic, Dunning says businesses aren't expecting federal aid this time around.
Because it's the federal level that is causing the disruption.
Impacted businesses and community organizations in the area have been meeting to brainstorm solutions.
We need either philanthropic support or we need state-level support. We need city-oriented programming that would help businesses with whatever resources they have.
Dunning says ESABA plans to reach out to state lawmakers to discuss possible legislative proposals, with the session set to begin in February. Alma Flores, the executive director of the Latino Economic Development Center, or LEDC, is exploring pathways for support as well. LEDC is located on the east side, but provides loans and support to small businesses across Minnesota.
Finding some rent relief is critical at this time, alongside payroll, and then making sure their debts are paid so that there isn't this ripple effect that we expect to see.
She's in conversation with other local organizations, private funders, and new St. Paul Mayor Kali Herr about creating emergency aid. While these plans are still in the works, Flores estimates the economic impact of this situation would be significant if something isn't done soon.
We are seeing about a $400,000 impact potentially if this continues for the next 6 months. And statewide, we looked at it from our portfolio standpoint, and it's over $1 million. If we were to provide some relief just on their loans, this does not speak to their needing to pay their rent, make payroll. So obviously the need is greater than that.
St. Paul Councilmember Hwa Jung Kim says there aren't many options in this current situation.
You know, we have emergency assistance for renters, but we don't have a ton for businesses.
Still, she says she's looking into whatever resources and opportunities are available.
You know, there are businesses that have accessed business grants with us. We're taking a look at those. Some of our offices have, you know, small pots of money, usually for capital improvement. And it is written out in state legislature. But of course, the legislature starts in about a month.
Meanwhile, in a statement via email, the president and CEO of St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation says they've upped grant making and are contributing to the Immigrant Rapid Response Fund at the Women's Foundation. On the ground, one business owner says he's glad for the help coming from the community.
They're doing deliveries for they're supporting us. It's amazing.
He's hoping changes will be coming soon. But until then, he'll continue to do his part.
We need to keep the hope, keep working hard. We have to take care of our community and take care of each other.
This is Nak Bui for North Star Stories.
Businesses and customers across the state are being impacted by the immigration crackdown. I'm now joined by King Banyan, director of the Center for Policy Research and Community Engagement and professor of economics at St. Cloud State University. Welcome to North Star Stories. Thank you so much for being here, professor.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So we don't have data on the current situation, but from an economic standpoint, what kinds of long-term ripple effects do you expect on jobs, commercial rents, and vacancy rates?
Well, what we have here is a economic story about labor supply and about business continuity. We have lots of reports that show large-scale enforcement is causing many businesses to close. Your stories in the Twin Cities match stories we've had here in the St. Cloud area, where I have business owners, both members of immigrant communities and those not, having trouble getting workers to come to work. And it happens in a variety of sectors, though the front line of it's going to be in the restaurant sector, which is consistent with a number of the stories we're hearing. But it also happens in construction. It also happens in childcare, which has ripple effects that we could talk about, and basically administrative services as well.
Elaborate a little bit more. You mentioned it'll have effects on childcare.
So suppose someone who's in childcare, you know, is a member of an immigrant community, and they decide they don't want to go to work because they think it's unsafe. They might get questioned in their place of work. So they stay home. There's a minimum number of childcare workers you have to have in order to watch the children. If you get below that number, you have to basically close the childcare facility. Now you have parents who will say, I can't come to work because my child got sent home from childcare. So now it can be even somebody who's not a member of an immigrant community who's being affected by this action.
So what impact do you expect this will have on local sales tax collections? And how might that affect the city and state budgets going forward?
Well, many cities will collect money on food and beverage that will be impacted this month and in coming months from lower sales. You've got restaurants that are closing here. I saw a notice from one restaurant over in St. Joseph near us that just said they're not going to be open for the foreseeable future. So you will see a drop in that food and beverage tax. You will also see, I think, broader sales tax implications as well, coming out of the fact that there's less commerce that's going to happen. Commerce involves people being out and engaging with each other. There's less of that happening when people are unwilling to go into public.
I would like to hear from you. Like, is there anything you'd like to share that I haven't touched on?
Well, Grace, I would say probably the most important part to remember is the ripple effects, the fact that you may think to yourself, this is just something that's happening to the immigrant community, and my heart might go out to them and so forth, but it's not impacting me in some tangible economic way. That's not true, okay? I think it's most certainly the case that the ripple effects from this, the longer it goes on, will show up in impacts here. Another example, probably not a big issue right now because most construction workers who are immigrants are in particular subcontractors like roofing. I'm a fan of many of the Latin American restaurants here in the St. Cloud area. Many of them at lunchtime will have roofing crews having their lunch. They're not around in the winter anyway, because who goes on a roof in the winter? But as time goes on, those people, you're having work done in your house. Those people are not coming to work, and all of a sudden, you might be building a new home, and you can't get them to come in, to that subcontractor to come in to do their part. And the rest of your building of your home is waiting, not for a part, but for a worker. And that impact in construction, I think, will become more apparent as we move into spring and summer. It's not probably as apparent right now. It's just a matter of how long will this increased enforcement last in our community.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Banyan.
Thank you.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, has reached a nearly $3 million enforcement agreement with Enbridge Energy over a fourth confirmed aquifer breach tied to the Line 3 replacement project near Moose Lake in northern Minnesota. According to AMPR's member station, KAXE, Enbridge officials first reported a small groundwater leak at the site in August 2022 with flows of 10 to 15 gallons per minute, far lower than previous breaches. Under the agreement, Enbridge will fund environmental projects, pay civil penalties, cover ongoing monitoring, and provide financial assurance for any future impacts, while the DNR continues to watch conditions at Moose Lake and along the Line 3 corridor. A natural gas pipeline explosion shook a rural area near Willow River in east central Minnesota. Officials reported no injuries, but said that more than 600 Minnesota Energy Resources customers lost heat. The power company had to ask customers to keep their thermostats at 60 degrees temporarily until they could establish a more permanent fuel supply. Pine County authorities and investigators say they do not suspect anything criminal, but are still trying to determine the cause of the explosion. Well, good news for fans of the Minnesota State Fair. The admission and parking prices are going to stay the same as last year. This year's fair will start on August 27th and run through September 7th. At its 167th annual meeting in St. Paul, the board that oversees the State Fair also approved more than $67 million in spending to upgrade the fairgrounds, improve the guest experience, and expand educational and entertainment programs. AMPRS, which produces and distributes North Star Stories, will have a booth once again this year in the Education Building, where a different AMPRS station broadcasts from the booth each day. Be sure to stop by and see us. That's all the time we have for today's program. If you missed any part of today's newscast, you can find this and past episodes at AMPRS.org or listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on social media. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with more stories and voices from the North Star State.
North Star Stories is produced by AMPRS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at AMPRS.org.
You can tell it's a cold day.
The beautiful squeak of my boots on the driveway snow. I'm going to tell you something. Okay, so it's 9 degrees as we are talking right now. Mm-hmm. And we got an extreme cold weather advisory, cold watch, where we're living here in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. It's Charlie Mitchell. It's Season Watch. I get a little bit, what is the word, Charlie? Help me out here. So today happens to be my birthday. The weather.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I didn't want to say it like that, but my point is the weather is always like this on January 21st. So I'm not mad exactly. But I tried to be John Latimer.
I feel like the number of people who say I'm not mad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who are mad are like above 50, but sure, you're not mad exactly.
I'm not mad at you, Charlie. I'm just disappointed.
No, that's so much worse.
I tried to be John Latimer. I figured there was somewhere online where I could find out what the temperature was the day I was born and where I was born in Minneapolis. So to look that up. And then it also had every year after that. But of course, I moved various places, so I had to kind of look it up.
Yeah.
The data didn't bear out what my memory is, so maybe we just don't need to talk about that. It always seems too cold. It was about 20, I think maybe even 30 degrees on the day I was born.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
According to this, I mean, it was, to be honest, it was a little bit of a fishy sight. It was, you know, it was kind of one of those where the highlights made it unreadable. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like 1997 internet, so perhaps it wasn't correct. But I'm going to try to embrace the squeakiness. How's that?
That works. Well, happy very cold birthday.
Thank you.
NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, whatever it is, has or had all that data running back years and years and years, which would be a more reliable site to find that information. But I also know, like, a lot of that climate data is disappearing. So I don't know whether that's still publicly available.
Okay. So it's a good day to talk about nature and just to connect ourselves, right? With, hey, it's squeaky out there. It's really cold. There's still stuff going on.
There absolutely is. And it's about to get a lot colder. So let's appreciate the 9 degrees while we've got them.
Yeah, true enough. Well, so this week, we were glad to get kind of back on things with some student reports. We talked with John Latimer, another interview this week that got us really curious about nesting cavities.
Absolutely. That was a fascinating interview.
Up first, though, I think we should we take a listen to our friends from Little Falls?
Always, happily.
This is
Mattia,
Cora,
and Olivia reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is a phenology report for the week of January 18th.
With the warmer temperatures, more and more vole tunnels are being exposed in our yards.
We have had multiple red fox sightings this week all during the day, so we are guessing that mating season must be starting.
Two different people spotted woolly bear caterpillars this week, and we are puzzled by that one.
We did get to start exploring with a UV flashlight that we got from Charlie Mitchell. We looked at some lichen and are excited to see what other discoveries we will make this year with the new way of seeing things.
We have had observations of four chickadees chasing each other aggressively on a tree.
Speaking of chickadees, we learned that a number of D's in the chickadee DD call indicates the level of danger they are feeling.
An easy sighting this time of year are the trails left on old trees by bark beetles. They remind us of carvings or hieroglyphics.
There are six bald eagles spotted in a field, but we noticed it was close to a chicken barn, so there might be some carcasses dumped there.
A classmate brought in an owl pellet that she found at her house. We pulled it apart and found it was full of vole bones and hair.
We had another opossum sighting this week, as one was running up a tree grabbing apples.
There are golden-eyed ducks hanging out in an open stretch of the Mississippi River here in town. It is a rare chance to see diving ducks around Little Falls.
This is our report for this week. Until next week,
keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
Well, Heidi, do you remember the difference between a pellet and a scat? Not to pop quiz you.
Yeah, no, I don't. Is it about what matter is included within there? I don't remember this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the pellet comes out the top and scat comes out the bottom. Yeah.
Oh,
so
okay.
The pellet is all the dry matter, the fur, the bones, the other stuff that the owl can't digest. And instead of passing it through their whole digestive system, they just cough it up.
Okay, so an owl then only has a pellet or has pellet and scat?
Has pellet and scat.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yep. So the meat and, you know, all of that stuff does go through their digestive system and there's still leftover. So that comes out as scat. Along with their urine.
Speaking of urine, let's talk a little bit about this UV flashlight and what it can provide. So you felt like these students needed this, apparently.
So this was a surprise gift that I got maybe 2 or 3 years ago from my father-in-law, which I know that people who are really into insects use UV lights to find them, like especially scorpions and stuff will like glow at night under UV. And people who are into mushrooms also are interested in UV, but it had never popped into my mind as a little gadget that I needed to have until I got one and started exploring. And yeah, these very nondescript gray lichens under UV glow like this beautiful gold, like vibrant, rich, luminous gold. Of course, I don't recommend taking it inside because that's how you figure out where the mice are. But I found that otter scat, at least when they're eating a lot of crayfish, that fluoresces. It turns like this really like neon yellow. I found these little aquatic snails that glow orange. It's just a whole new, it's seeing the world through a whole different lens that I hadn't really expected. And after we talked with Chad, I think 2 weeks ago, I was just inspired to send them that little piece of delight and see what they might find.
And it sounds like, I think John had mentioned that sometimes deer hunters are using that. They can kind of be following where the deer urine lights up.
Really? That's smart. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I was thinking that might be a good, there might be some deer urine curiosity in my household. It might be a good stocking gift, but I don't know. One of those things, probably it probably is in my house right now, and I just don't know about it because this is the first time I've heard of this UV light. So others apparently know about it. But yeah, this is just another example of this curiosity, and they're noticing all these things despite the midst of winter.
Yes. And, you know, especially in winter when things are a little bit slower, it's a good excuse to get outside and see things in a new light, literally, in this case. Now, my big dream, someone discovered, and like, I'm sure this was just some naturalist out there looking for insects or something that had their UV on and saw a flash of pink going past, but someone discovered that flying squirrels fluoresce pink on their bellies. And it is my absolute dream to get a picture of that, because all of the pictures online of flying squirrels under UV are, of course, copyrighted. And I want to get pictures in the newsletter and to show them to all my friends.
Charlie has a dream.
So someday, Charlie does have a dream.
Oh.
See a pine marten and get a picture of a flying squirrel under UV.
Have a lynx in your backyard for a week. Yep. All these things that could happen.
Too much to ask, Heidi.
No, it's not. It can exist.
Okay. I believe. John Latimer had a bit to teach me about squirrels this week, too.
Cottontail rabbits are still fairly common. Red squirrels are out eating. I had a gray squirrel in my yard eating. We've talked about the competition between the gray squirrel and the red squirrel. We know that the red squirrels are much more aggressive because they have hidden food caches, and the gray squirrels tend to just go and eat when they are hungry. And they come to my feeder and help themselves to some sunflower seeds that usually the downy and hairy woodpeckers have spread around, because the my feeder, if they're not going to the suet, they get up in the seed pile and they flip their heads back and forth, left and right, and they scatter seeds everywhere. And at first I thought they were looking for a particular seed, but what I realized they're doing is they're searching for the nut, the meat of the seed without the seed coating on it, so that they don't have to hack their way in. They're sifting through the pile looking for those little unshelled meats, and in doing so they kick a lot of seeds off the edge, which makes the squirrels happy because then they get a chance to eat a little bit too, and the rabbits as well.
I loved that note about why red squirrels are so feisty. That's something that I've always kind of loved about them, is they're, you know, these tiny adorable creatures that will take on a gray squirrel or a pileated woodpecker and just seem to have no fear, just all audacity. I love them. But that makes a lot of sense why they are that way, since they have all of these stored pine cones and stuff to protect, versus the gray squirrels who are just kind of out, you know, foraging every day.
Foraging, but yet still leaping onto bird feeders. And the acrobatics of the squirrels is amazing, I think.
Absolutely.
When you think about how big they are relative to the birds.
Yeah.
You know, uh-huh. I mean, it really is pretty amazing. The heavyweights are competing with like the, you know, the smallest weights. And it's just, if you're, I guess I have Olympics coming on the brain or something, but it seems a little unfair.
Yeah. And yet some of those birds will drive off those squirrels no problem. I saw, you know, those tiny red-breasted nuthatches?
Mm-hmm.
Feisty. I've seen them chase off a gray squirrel. The size differential.
We talk about we want to be connected to nature and what it provides. It seems like what Season Watch ends up for us. But I hadn't really thought about that we're also learning character traits that we like, that we want. Like I'd love to be called feisty all day long, you know? That's something I work towards.
Yep.
So we're taking cues in our own character from nature, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And I think, you know, there's a long and positive history of that. We've been inspired by animals for ever.
Yeah.
As we should be. Yeah. There's times when, like, I look at, like, a great blue heron just, like, standing still next to the river. I'm like, oh, I wish, A, that that was my life, and B, that I had the patience for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
There's another thing. I mean, I think I'm thinking about in a new year, you know, if you let yourself think about the scramble of daily life and the amount of input mm-hmm. coming at you, it's not quite, I think you, no one expert has to tell you it's not quite healthy, you know?
No. Yep.
And that we need to have more of that stand by the riverbank. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that John and I talked about this week was, or one of the student groups brought up that I was glad to hear again and be reminded of is sit spots. You know how you and I talked about, you know, when we began 2026 that maybe, you know, we don't need a resolution, but let's have some nature goals, right? To include more mm-hmm. birds that we know what they are and, you know, we can name. But maybe it's also about, like, find that sit spot.
Yeah.
Somewhere you go back to time and time again. You yeah. keep watching. It was the first time I ever heard it was from the storied Harry Hutchins, who you never got to meet, yeah. but have heard so much about. And his Aldo Leopold benches, which John got into a little bit this week, and how much notation and how much time he spent on those benches mm-hmm. and what it meant to him. And yeah, it's just, I think that's a really good idea because sometimes we get in our heads that in order to experience nature, we got to keep going to different places.
For me, when I was thinking about sit spots, there were a couple places that really came to mind. One of them is just on the river near my parents' house. There's this big, big old glaciated rock that I'm sure was picked up by the glaciers, brought down here and just left by the side of the river. And you can tell it was in place in the river when the glacial melt was happening because there are these, for me, they're like these beautifully carved little footrests for me to put my feet on. But I'm sure that it was, you know, years of rocks tumbling against this huge boulder that made them, because they're smooth, they're perfectly carved out. That's just been a really nice spot for me over the years. You know, I went there when I was a teenager and having a hard time. When I lost grandparents, I would sit there. And like, or like when I'm in a new relationship, I often go down and I sit there. And just been there and kind of feeling the solace of nature a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you see so many cool things, whether it's an eagle hunting or an osprey hunting, or in the winter, like the little otter tracks that come up from holes in the ice. But yeah, sit spots, man, they can mean a lot. And you get to see so many cool things from them. Do you have a favorite spot?
You know, I was trying to think that. What this was making me think of, I don't think I've ever told you mm-hmm. about a local artist to the Grand Rapids area. Kristen Anderson is her name. And she does felted wool art. Mm. And it's as if she's drawing nature with wool. And it's glorious, the stuff she does, you know, and she does mm-hmm. commissioned work and all kinds of different things. But in recent years, she's been creating sit spots that she sells. And I bought a couple of them. So it's rolled up mm-hmm. wool that looks like a river or, you know, it looks like a nature scene that you're supposed to take with mm-hmm. you. It's got a little piece of leather on it so you could hook it to something. I, of course, don't use it for that because it's really beautiful. It's a piece of art on my wall. But they're called sit uh-huh. spots or sit upons. Sit upons, maybe, is how she.
Yeah, sit upons.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But same concept, you know, and that interesting thing of how it influences this act of what we're talking about influences people in different ways, you know, at hard mm-hmm. times, to make art, to pass it on to other people, mm-hmm. you know, those sorts of things. Like a sit upon would be a great, like if we had all the money in the world for our phenology students, like everyone should get a sit upon.
Right.
And a UV light.
I know a lot of the elementary schools will do like a gallon-sized Ziploc bag with a bunch of newspaper stuffed in it.
Mm.
It's waterproof. Makes a nice spot to sit.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. A beautiful wool sit upon.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, in the nicer weather, the deck is where I'm outside the most, or...
Yeah.
You know, we go back to, sometimes I want to explore a little more when we're on the lake, but we go back to these few places again and again, and it's because mm-hmm. it's where the eagles have nested. There's other things we know were there the year before, so we want to check if it's still there. We're sometimes snowshoeing over to those spots now, mm-hmm. And this time of year. So I guess, you know, it might be lake for me a little bit more is what I'm paying yeah. attention to in those spots. And I didn't really think about, it doesn't have to be a new thing, you uh-huh. know, like that thing you think, oh, well, we should be checking out this whole other part. And it's like, maybe not. Maybe that's just yeah. fine.
And parts of it are, you know, stuff that you've already do, but you just like have a new term for it now. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe you see it in a little bit different light. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love the sit spots.
So you got to hear some of the conversation we had this week about these nest cavity. Wait, no. How do we describe these guys?
Yeah, nest cavities with woodpeckers.
Yeah, and it's a new series, so we'll be talking about more species, critters that yes. need these nest cavities. But we had a chance to talk with Mike North from the DNR. I'm assuming this fascinated you.
Oh, absolutely. Right up my alley.
All right, let's take a listen.
There are woodpeckers of various sizes, obviously. What are some of the size of trees that they really seek out when they're looking for cavities?
Yeah, they do use a wide variety of sizes, but they really do hone in on a certain narrow size range. So, for example, for downy woodpeckers, if they're nesting in aspen trees, it's a 10 to 12 inch aspen that they're looking for the most part. If they're not in an aspen tree, then they often look for much bigger trees, ones that are greater than 16 inches. The hairy woodpeckers are looking for ones that are about 11 to 13 inches. The yellow-bellied sapsuckers about 12 to 14. And the northern flickers 13 to 15 inches DBH. That's the diameter of breast height. And then the pileates are using the bigger trees yet, typically 16 to 18 inches diameter at breast height. Aspen is the most important species in northern Minnesota for them to be nesting in. And they have different preferences for whether the trees are alive or dead. For example, in our study area north of Upper Red Lake between Lake of the Woods, we found that about 17% of the trees that downy woodpeckers nest in are live. The rest are dead. Hairy woodpeckers are really looking for live trees. About 95 to 97% of their trees are live trees. Sapsuckers the same, about 84% are live trees. Flickers like the downies like dead trees. Only about 35% of their nest trees are living trees. And then pileates also like live trees. About 75% of their nest trees are live. And one thing that we found that was very interesting is that they like slow-growing trees. Not necessarily the pileates, but the other four species like trees that are slower growing than average. And we didn't discover this until we started coring nest trees and other trees that were available for them on the landscape and taking those tree cores into a tree ring lab at Bemidji State University and actually aging them. And so putting a relationship to the age and the diameter of the tree together, they're finding these slow growing trees to nest in. And I think those slow growing trees are probably a stronger wood. So they're going to be more resistant to breakage and windstorms. The pileated woodpeckers, on the other hand, don't really care if it's a fast or slow growing tree. They just want a tree that's of a big size. And that's what they're focusing on. So a couple different tactics that the woodpeckers are doing and selecting trees.
Isn't that awesome? I've always thought it was really cool. You know, we had bird feeders growing up, and so I would watch the woodpeckers come and go, and just the fact that all of these different species seem to live together and visit, you know, they argue over who gets the feeder, but clearly all seem to get along just fine. And that makes so much sense because they're using these, they're partitioning up the habitat in these different ways. And I had not realized that about the nesting cavities.
This is where, you know, human nature is to think that these woodpeckers have thinking capacity because they're seeking out different things. But this is a whole different universe. It's not about thinking.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, these woodpeckers have been evolving side by side for millennia. And so it stands to reason that with that pressure from those other species, the ones most well adapted to living in that environment are the ones that can get along. I also thought that note about the slow growing trees, they prefer the slow growing trees, is so interesting. I don't know anything about this, so this is all conjecture, but if you think about what conditions form a slow growing tree, it's ones that are shaded, and so ones that are in the middle of the forest. And those roots are all connected to the roots of all the other trees around them and kind of sheltered from the big winds and stuff. And so if I was a woodpecker looking for a place to put my precious eggs and my precious babies, having a really strong one would make a lot of sense, one that isn't exposed to a ton of wind and one that's supported by much larger trees around it, all seem to like make a lot of sense for why you would want that tree.
Yeah, there was also some questions from John Latimer to Mike in this. And we also want to thank Mark Jacobs. You heard him at the beginning asking this question. He's the producer of these segments from Aiken County. But John asked if they ever are together in those nest cavities. And Mike had talked about they aren't like other birds that do that. You know, we were kind of thinking of it in terms of warmth. You know, that we'd be warmer if we were in the same nest cavity than if we were in separate ones, you know?
Yeah.
But also, it's a whole other world. Obviously, we use feathers to keep ourselves warm in blankets and things like that. Uh-huh. So birds kind of have, you know, they know what's going on in terms of warmth and stuff. But there's so many elements to that. And one thing that we have a lot of downed trees. And, you know, we keep them for critters. We take some out. We use some for firewood and stuff. But just that whole concept of all the different things, like you pointed out, that it's about fast-growing, slow-growing trees. It's about dead trees over alive trees. You know, just these really, there's so many decisions and things going out there in the woods for these little homes.
Yeah. And they're good at it. They can find the right tree, and it's amazing. And then even within, so for instance, the downy woodpecker, even within the species of the downy woodpecker, even within a mated pair, there's partitioning where I believe it's the males will forage mostly on the trunk of the tree and the females will forage on the limbs and the branches. And I think they both kind of switch back to the trunk during winter, but just the amazing specificity of these behaviors and the way they make it work. It's incredible. But I did want to talk a little bit about the like kind of four main species that I see at my place in winter, the downy woodpecker, the hairy woodpecker, the red-bellied, and then the pileated. The downy and the hairy are the ones that look most alike. They are small, black and white. The males will have a red patch at the back of the neck. But otherwise, they look so similar unless you have them right next to each other. The downy one is smaller than the hairy one. And I think about the way I remember that is like downies, like if you think about it, like a little bird covered in baby down, they're small. And then like a big hairy man is the larger one. But if you look, I think the easiest way to tell them apart is by looking at their little beak. The downy woodpeckers are primarily, their diet is mostly insects that they glean from the bark of trees. So they're like hopping up and down the trunk and just looking for small things that they can just pick out by sight. And they do a little bit of excavating, but they don't have that big chunky bill the way that hairy woodpeckers do. Hairy woodpeckers are much more likely to excavate for insects underneath the bark. And so that's, it'll take a while of observing them to be able to tell them apart, but that's one way to do it. The red-bellied woodpecker, I think, kind of looks like a zebra on its back. It's got these really clear checker mark. And I think the red-bellied woodpecker is badly named. The people who named it clearly had a dead specimen in their hand and were looking at it and were like, oh, there's kind of a reddish blush on the belly. I guess we'll call it a red-bellied woodpecker. Will you ever see the belly of a red-bellied woodpecker in the wild? No, they're always like clung up to the tree with their belly hidden. But they do have like rather dramatic red on their head. But they're like more generalists. They will feed on the ground. They'll excavate. They'll glean stuff. Sometimes they catch flies. Sometimes they eat fruit. Sometimes they eat other baby birds. But yeah, much more generalist. Then of course the pileated is huge and dinosaur-y, mm-hmm. and you can't miss it. We've got the smallest and the largest woodpecker in North America right here in our backyards. It's wonderful.
So before we go, we've talked about a lot of things today. We want to hear from folks. You can use SpeakPipe. There is a link on our web stories. You can find it in the podcast platforms as well. But we'd love to hear if there's a place you go back to time and time again where you notice the changes. Tell us mm-hmm. about the sit spot and maybe the sit upon you use or the stand spot, right?
Yeah, I would love to hear spaces that are special to people.
This has been another edition of the Season Watch Podcast. It's a place for those who are curious. We delve into the delights of nature, and we want to thank those who are involved today.
Absolutely. We have, of course, our friends at Little Falls, Chad Kaditz and his class. Heidi recorded the snow crunch sound. Thank you for that. Mike North, who is our woodpecker expert, as well as Mark Jacobs, who produced the segment. And then we're going to lead out here with a call from a red-bellied woodpecker. And that was recorded by Michael Urban in the Twin Cities area.
And as always, our thanks to John Latimer, inspiring us each and every week, right?
Yes, indeed.
In today's world of on-demand media streaming over the internet, one has to wonder, why does traditional radio still matter? I'm Steve Noy, IT and broadcast engineer for KAXC. Why do we work so hard to offer traditional broadcasting when people can just jump on the internet and get instant access? Well, here's why. KAXC is available to everyone in our listening area, no matter your financial or social status. Anyone with a radio can hear KAXE, and you get the same great experience whether you're a member, a business sponsor, or just hearing about us for the first time. We do stream on our website, but it doesn't take a costly internet connection to hear KAXE. That's why we're looking for your help. We serve the whole community, and we can't do that without you. Tell others about us, or text the word donate to 218-326-1234. KAXE is an equalizer, making great content available to you no matter who you are. KAXE is people-powered radio.